beginning.
Too many will come to order.
And I want to welcome everyone here for public hearing on House Bill 5015, the Economic Development Department's budget. The other day, we were taking public testimony, and one of the individuals was unable to make the presentation. Former Senator Mike Thorne, would you come back up, the director of Port of Portland? We deeply apologize that we were unable to get on the docket. We want to make sure that you have adequate time, especially with the fleet coming in today. We want to make sure that harbor is deep enough to accept that fleet for you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I have to confess to you that one of the things of not being on that side of the table is coming back is not a problem. I appreciate your extending the courtesy to us to have a chance to set a time and be here this morning. First of all, let me say for the record, officially I'm Mike Thorne, Executive Director of the Port of Portland. I'm here to comment on the House bill, the budget bill that you referred to, House Bill 5015, which is actually the vehicle that actually appropriates the funds for the Channel Deepening Project, which is envisioned in a bonding bill that's included in House Bill 2153, and those two work together. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is cover three or four basic points here, tell you quickly what the status of the project is, what it constitutes, tell you a little bit about what it means in terms of the interest of the state and why the legislature should be looking at the appropriation request, and in response to some of the questions that have been raised in the past relative to trying to provide you some measure so that you actually can quantify the benefit alternative, and that with some numbers that I have. I also believe you've been provided information from Keith Levitt, who works for the Port, is here with us this morning. Material has been provided to you, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to ask them to follow up on that. First of all, let me then say that the project itself is a project to deepen the Columbia River Channel from its present 40 feet to 43. The project is sponsored by both ports on the state of Washington side of the river. That includes Longview, Kalama, Woodland, and Vancouver. And then on the Oregon side of the river, the Port of Portland, St. Helens. At present, Astoria has not joined in terms of taking the project forward, but I want to say that Astoria was a part of the group that did the original feasibility study. And as you know, they just retained or hired a new executive director. I've had conversations with them, and it would not surprise me to see them soon joining the project. So it would be a project that includes the local support required by the federal government for the full project. The project is estimated to cost about $183 million. Of that, the federal government share would be $106 million in round numbers, 65%. And then 35% is paid for by the sponsors, which is divided between the two states, so it would be 17.5% roughly for Oregon and 17.5% for the state of Washington. To date, the state of Washington now has done what you have done last session and provided $10 million to the project. They have, in this case, something of an advantage in that they operate on an annual session basis, and their plans are, when they meet again next January, to provide the additional $17.7 million, at least that's their intent at this time, which we're asking the legislature this time to consider. The reason for the timing situation is that they actually, as we provided you, I believe, information, the critical date that money has to be spent for the project, assuming the schedule is retained, is May of 2001. You will be in session during 2001, but you will not in all likelihood have been able to process budgets, and so that's the time approximately $19.2 million, if I'm correct, has to be issued in checks, and given what you've already appropriated and what we're requesting today, that will give us the funds to bridge that gap. state of Washington has a short session, which runs approximately 60 days. It could extend somewhat, and they will have an opportunity to match what Oregon does, and we stay on the same schedule. So what I'm saying is the goal is to make sure that the two states are in lockstep. The Congress has already provided a contingent authorization to move forward with the project. Now, that's not to be confused with the appropriation. We'll go back in January or next session of Congress to get the funds appropriated. But we've had broad-based support from the delegations of Oregon, Washington, and actually Idaho and other states helping us move the project forward. That contingency is based upon receiving a favorable chief's report. That's the chief of the Army Corps of Engineers, which is basically a report that comes about after all the final environmental impact statements have been given, issued, responding to the questions that were raised in the draft statement, which we think we've done quite adequately. So that's the status of the project, where the Congress is and where the state of Washington is. All in all, things are moving on schedule as anticipated. Specifically to the questions of the economy and what does this mean and why should we do it, I call the channel for this state one of those defining moments when if you don't do it, you'll look back several years in the future and realize that this was obviously a major turning point in core infrastructure that will allow us to continue to be a viable economy. I just had a conversation yesterday with an individual who used to be at Intel to show you what transportation systems means to what it takes to make an economy work. If you recall, in yesterday's Oregonian, there was an article stating that in 1997, the Oregon economy was the fastest growing economy in the country, and high-tech industry was credited for much of that growth. The individual told me that the chip that's produced, the wafer that's produced in the global operation, before it's put to final use, travels around the world three times. It may leave, say, the Hillsboro plant. It could go to Singapore, Malaysia, someplace. It's put into a motherboard. That goes someplace. It's maybe put into some other component. When it gets to the final finished product in the computer, the distance it travels is the equivalent of three times around the world on average. A Nike shoe, Nike, a company homegrown, their sole, their Nikes, produced in Beaverton area, put on an airplane, sent to someplace in Asia, potentially, added to then the manufacturing that goes to the sole, and that could be put ultimately in a steamship and taken someplace in the world. As this economy continues to grow and we become more globalized, transportation systems are the only way that we can continue to provide trade. And that's the bottom line core of what this project is all about. How do we retain the ability to continue to have the access to world markets through one of the options we have, and that's steamship service. It's estimated presently that in 98, there was nearly 30 million metric tons of cargo that moved out the Columbia River system. The value of that was around $12.5 billion. On a recent economic study, the support updates, in fact, we try to analyze what that means in terms of jobs directly. It's estimated in 97 that activity represented about 6,196 jobs that were directly impacted or directly employed in moving products. When you take influence jobs, an influence job could be the job that exists over here in a freight forwarder's activity warehouse as a result of the ability of the cargo is moving through a serious channels to get to its ultimate destination. It's estimated about 60,500 jobs in the PNW Pacific Northwest are related to this activity. So from a job activity, it's important, and from an overall value activity, it's extremely important. It's estimated that annually, if you take the income tax flow that comes out of trade and transportation, about $23 million annually comes to the state general fund. And interestingly enough, to give you an idea of what's happening in the Oregon economy as we move from a wood products economy to an integrated manufacturing economy, the Portland metropolitan area, and that's the only reason I cite that is simply because that's where the stuff comes to get on a ship or a plane or whatever. 27th largest population base in the country is the 10th largest trade and transportation center in the United States. So we are, in fact, a trade transportation center. Trade and transportation essentially is key in driving the Oregon economy. And that's the reason that from our expectation and anticipation, this project is so important. You heard on Monday's hearing when I was here that The Portland Harbor is the number one beet exporting harbor in the United States and ranks number two in terms of total grain. Grain would be in addition to wheat, barley, and oats and other types of grain products, removed corn, that sort of thing. And we're the second largest West Coast tonnage port. We think of Los Angeles, we think of Puget Sound and others as being larger, but Portland is the number two port in terms of tonnage, export tonnage on the West Coast. There was a question raised which I could refer to about what happens in terms of just local communities. Let me just give you some examples of some of the export cargoes that move out of the Portland Harbor. Hay and hay products has become one quarter or 24% of the stuff that we export. It's an interesting comparison, Mr. Chairman. You remember well the years when we were dealing with field burning, and we were trying to figure out how to manage that problem. There was some 250,000, 300,000 acres burned today. I guess it's probably less than 25,000 or some smaller number. An awful lot of that product is basically high-compressed straw that's now baled and moved to Asia, particularly Japan, for use in feed products and that sort of thing. Paper products, which basically at one time we exported logs, today products are moved as a result of being processed into milk carton stock, paperboard and paperboard products. Adolf Hertrick, the boring, would take basically a home and put it in a container, complete with the appliances, and export it to Japan, integrating the concept of value-added manufacturing. Agricultural products, in addition to hay products, frozen French fries, much of the McDonald's French fries that you find in Asia basically come out of eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, Idaho, an awful lot of that out of Oregon, Simplot's products that come out of eastern Oregon. And the list goes on of how we've managed to take an integrated value-added economy and move that product into a viable world market. On the import side, and much of our products move export. We're more of an export center. On the import side, the largest importer or import product is footwear, and that should come as no surprise. The stuff is primarily driven by Nike. Interestingly enough, for those from Central Oregon, tires is about 7% of all of our import product, and Les Schwab basically has probably 65% to 75% of the tire business in the Willamette Valley, and probably has all of it in eastern Oregon, for all I know. The list goes on. This transportation network is what keeps the economy working in so many different parts of our state. The Corps estimates as far as what the value is in their study, sort of the return on investment concept, that the annual value of having the shipping channel deepened by 3 feet is equivalent to $38 million annually. Those numbers come basically from this. Add 1 foot of depth, you can put that much more cargo on a ship. 1 foot of depth will give about $2.8 million worth of extra value that you can put on a ship per sailing. And 1 foot of depth will give about $250,000 more wheat per sailing. And it's that basis that drives the assumptions relative to return on investment. I mentioned that the contingent authorization relates to having adequately answered the questions raised in the draft environmental impact statement. Senator Deuce, I think you're well aware of some of the issues related to that. We believe we are moving successfully to address some of the issues that the crab fishers have raised from where the draft statement was to the environment to the final statement, as well as upland disposal and other issues that were raised basically in the project. The project itself is a very simple project to do. Presently, the majority of the river is already below 43 feet. This project would take about 25 to 30% and take it to the 43-foot level. In many cases in the river are 50, 60, and 70 feet deep. The project really is, how do you take then the environmental implications of the project, address them adequately in a final statement so we can move forward. The actual dredging is a very simple process. It will take about 18 months to do. Mm-hmm. With that, Mr. Chairman, go on at some length here, and I appreciate your time constraints. I'd be pleased to answer any questions that you or your committee has, and appreciate the time to be here.
Thank you, Mike. The question I have is, last session we appropriated the use of $10 million towards the match. This session is another $17 million, making a total of $27
million.
Is it more prudent to make the commitment, or is it more prudent to sell the bonds, invest the bonds, and generate some additional income off of the bond income?
Mr. Chairman, I may not be the right one to answer that question. I believe that, I'm not clear, but I don't believe there's much value gained in trying to create an arbitrage on the sale of the bonds. There was a time when that would have been...
Okay, that's what I'm trying to find out.
If, I will leave a bit of a question behind my answer in that I'm not absolutely sure, but I believe that's correct. That I think...
it is correct. Yeah. Okay, Mr. Scott, it's not on the end.
I appreciate
that. No, I didn't...
I noted for the record.
I wanted to know because at one time it was... supposedly more attractive to do it that way.
Mr. Chairman, as you recall, there was a time when there was a tremendous opportunity to use interest rate arbitrage, and many projects in the state have been financed as a result of that.
My other question is, state of Washington is applying itself to $27 million too?
Mr. Chairman, they presently have approved $10 million, as the state of Oregon has, and they plan to approve an additional, the state of Washington, the sponsors have to come up with the same amount that we do, and their intentions are to get their next chunk of money.
And that overall is one-third of the actual cost?
Actually, 35%. The combined 17.7 is basically, or 27.7. 27.7 is 17.5%. So you add those two together, and that's 35%.
Right. Representative Beck.
Thanks, Chair. The question in my mind is the why 43 feet, why not 47 or 42.5? I think I've heard before, but the question is.
Chairman, Representative Beck, well over 10 years ago, there was a reconnaissance study done, and that was the foundation of beginning to look at what we, what then we thought would be the appropriate draft necessary to accommodate vessel activity and access to Portland. The reason 43 feet was chosen, we have the advantage of some tidal effects in the river system that can add as much as 2 feet during, depending upon how the tidal flow works. When you add that to the 43 feet, which is the minimum level that the channel will retain at, then compare what we anticipated the vessel draft needs to be well into the year 2000, beyond 2015. It was the conclusion then, and it still holds today, that 43 feet will provide us an opportunity to serve in the neighborhood of 80% of all of the vessels that conceivably would call the Columbia River. You have to go beyond that, I think, one step to realize that the real, really large, the mega ships that conceivably could draft 45 and 48 feet, maybe as much as 50, are those vessels used in some of the really concentrated trade routes, Hong Kong, Los Angeles, for an example. Rotterdam is a major port. And those are the ports that basically have the backup infrastructure that can accommodate, you know, vessels that are carrying 7,000 potentially 8,000 TEUs, which is a term used to describe each container that's on a ship. The conclusion was, when you look at the Portland and the Pacific Northwest market, the vessels of in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 5,500 TEU, which this draft will accommodate, will serve us well into the next century. And so the conclusion was that, from a cost-effective standpoint, that was the best way to serve the market and still keep the project within reasonableness as far as cost and environmental impacts, potentially, as you go deeper.
So, will this, are we gonna, are people going to make their decision on whether to bring ships in and out based on whether their ship is 80% full or 50% full? Does the additional depth accommodate ships being at full capacity, or they still going to be making choices as to whether they can only load? I guess part of that thing is, are we doing it all? Still, ships are going to make choices, and we can't go to Portland because they can only put 80% of the load in there.
Representative Beck, I think you know, everything is relative, but I think in the practical world we live in, the debts that we're looking at will be adequate to accommodate probably 80 to 85% of the vessels that conceivably will be in the trade. Now, take that down to what?
Fully loaded.
Fully loaded.
Okay.
Take that one step further. Vessels that are exporting products usually draw deeper, than those that are importing. And so if there was a case of trade-off on that marginal 10, 15% we're talking about then, vessel owners could modify their rotation. For an example, instead of leaving Portland on a last call, going, say, to Japan on an export basis, it could modify the rotation, pick up cargo in Portland on the middle stop, if you will, depart lighter, and then maybe top off, say, in the Puget Sound or Vancouver, British Columbia. There's some options that the vessel owners have that they could adjust rotations. Inbound cargo is lighter than outbound cargo. And so if you got to the limitations, there is ways in which you can adjust that. But really the guiding factor in this is going to be the marketplace. And we think that when we look around the world, the capacity available to handle at land side these large mega ships is very limited. It does no good to have 200 million, 150 million tied up in a vessel that stays at a dock 8 days or 7 days because of all the cargoes trying to unload, and the railroads aren't there to support it, and the roads aren't there to support it, so you lose the value of that investment. So I think as a practical matter, we still believe that this is the depth that will serve the Portland market well into the future. And until such time, the rest of the world improves its land-side access so you can move products efficiently, I think this will serve us quite adequately.
Okay, Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to see you, Director Swan. I remember I started Raven News when Mike was chairman of Raven News, and he always said, keep your target wide. That's an Eastern Oregon language.
This is a public meeting.
And hey, you're fine. You're going. You didn't listen.
All the time, I thought face powder. But you always predicted people's questions, so you predicted my question. But my question is, what is the increase in job creation after the channel deepening? And I know you said currently the port creates 6,900 jobs, and each foot that's deepened increase cargo value 2.8 million, but what does it mean in terms of job creation?
Sorry, I can't give you an exact number of what it means in terms of job creation. I will be able to tell you that after the fact. We do anticipate, though, that the actual benefit as a result of the project, the core study, this is not ours, this is a core study, $38 million annually. They get there.
$38 million
annually. They get there by using basically some assumptions. I'll try to describe it. It is anticipated that if you don't deepen the channel over time, then Portland will not be a major player, will not be able to serve the Oregon market. And at some point, those products may well have to move to other ports because there aren't vessels calling. That's the logic that they use to get to that number. Presently, in round numbers, there's about 200,000 boxes a year, containers a year, going through the Port of Portland. It is estimated the cost to dray that cargo, if Portland didn't exist, to say the Puget Sound by truck, is anywhere in the neighborhood of $200 to $350. It could be more per trip. Just the cost plus the congestion you've got on roads and the other factors that play out. And so you use that macroeconomic basis as the basis of trying to then work backwards to say, well, what's the value then to Oregon shippers? To the businesses, whether it's a person that's shipping hay products from the valley or any kind of product wherever it is, will then have to pay that additional cost. Presently, that cost is paid by the steamship line because they pick up the product in Portland and have a Portland bill of lading. So if that product cost is moved over to the shipper, the exporter, then that's where the $38 million economic value comes into play. And then ultimately the question is, if it costs more per container to move a product, the company then has to ask themselves, suddenly my cost of doing business has gone up. Can I continue to compete if I stay where I am? Does that mean I have to relocate my plant? That was an actual case, Mr. Chairman, with novices in Medford area. When I first came to port, they had lost, Portland had lost the bill of lading for fruit bound to Europe. Suddenly those costs that they were paying to move fruit to ship to Europe, which the steamship lines used to pay, became their responsibility. 1,000 containers a year, $400 a box, $400,000 additional cost for no added value. That's how the economics roll into what the Corps is saying in terms of what the gross value is. Now, what that means to jobs is a little harder to predict, Senator Yee, and I would be better able to describe that, I think, after the fact when we actually saw what the increase in value was. That's a very conservative approach at looking at what economic value is. It assumes no upside. It assumes continuing to serve the market. And this project is important in order to be able to stay in business and continue to serve the market demands of the state of Oregon.
Okay. Yes.
Now, does the project depend on the environmental study? I mean, is it dependent on the conclusion of the study?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, this project will not move forward until the environmental questions have been adequately addressed. And that's the reason the contingent authorization. The Congress has approved the project contingent upon a final environmental impact statement and a chief's report, which is due in August originally, and that may slip a little bit. The Congress has approved the project. The Senate bill, and there's some difference between the Senate and the House bill. One says a chief's report by the end of the year. The other is by the end of the fiscal year. That's, I think, given the mechanics of working out the two conferences between the House and the Senate. But the report, the final environmental impact statement, is will be the key factor here. The funds are being lined up and set up to go. And as I reported earlier, we believe, through a lot of extra effort that we've put into the project, that those things can be adequately addressed. The issues that are pending. I mentioned the crab fishery as being one of the major issues.
And we expect the study in August.
We expect a chief's report in August at this moment, although I have reason to believe that may slip a little bit. But in the Senate bill, they said the deadline is by the end of the year. So we're still working with the Congress. And in fact, I could go back next week to talk to them a little more about their schedule.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to stampede to apologize. We ran out of time the other day while Mr. Thorne was here, and Director Thorne and I do apologize. Honestly, I do, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I accept your apology. We'll just never chair the subcommittee.
Mr. Chairman, the apology is certainly not necessary. You can do the request on client.
No, I'm just right.
I can make it in the form of a motion if you
want.
Is the 6535 standard in relationship to these kinds of projects? And I'll ask a question I've asked before. Where is Idaho in this process? Because when we talk about wheat, probably two-thirds of the wheat that we're really talking about is really not directly from this central part of Oregon area.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Butler, in response to your question, first of all, to the cost sharing, that's set by federal statute. And there has been some consideration at the federal level to change that to 50-50, but that's been resisted for obvious reasons. And it's 65-35. So the question you raised about where's the state of Idaho, the state of Idaho is actually very supportive, as you would expect, and for the precise reasons that you described. A lot of the product moves down the Snake River system, Lewiston, a lot of their products move out of Boise and the greater Treasure Valley area. the reason the state of Idaho is not a part of the project, again, is more by a matter of federal definition. This is a project that involves the Columbia River. The Columbia River system doesn't, the Columbia River doesn't run to Idaho, the Snake River does. And so, simply by definition, they're not a sponsor of the project, although we've enjoyed tremendous support from their congressional delegation, as we have from the state of Montana and the Dakotas and on further to the east. That's, if you took the question one step further, would they be willing to volunteer? I can't answer that question for you. I know that they've been very supportive to the extent that the statutes require their support or limited.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And a follow-up question relative to the death and the environmental issues, which have both been touched upon. Historically, is the depth actually over 43 feet from a historical, or 40 feet from a historical standpoint, so that it would have been the 43 feet had the flushing occurred on a regular flood basis? And secondly, environmentally, when we take it back, are we other than the issue of potential pollutants that are settled and so forth, aren't we really just cleaning up the channel because of the more sedentary nature of the water and the more controlled nature of the upper reaches of the water controlled by dams at this particular point?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer the questions that Mr. Butler raised. First of all, to the depth issue, go back about 110 years, the Port of Portland was created by the legislature to deepen the Columbia River Channel from then 12 feet to 25, I think, or some level. Without the control structures in place, there was a lot of shoaling. This is, you would see snow drifts, and as the wind blows, you get snow piles up in some areas and other areas. It doesn't have sort of the same effects on the bottom of the river. So depth really is more a function of maintenance and continued authorization to deepen the channel. And it has less to do with the structures that are on the channel than it does just simply with maintaining a deeper channel. To the stuff in the river, the question you raise is not just a matter of just taking out stuff that potentially is polluted. There is no, interestingly enough, there is no pollution in the Columbia River. There has been, in this project originally, there was some consideration of the Willamette, and it's been put on a different schedule simply because there is some concern in the Willamette River system. We're not planning this particular authorization appropriation to go forward there. The test of what the value of the sand is, actually today there's a commercial market that has developed for Columbia River sand that's estimated that somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million cubic yards a year is actually being taken out by commercial dredge people and sold. It is a valuable aggregate used in construction. So the material's clean. It has tremendous value in terms of, and we anticipate going forward, that's a viable income stream. In fact, I haven't touched on that, but the Division of State Lands charges about 50 cents a yard, 48 or some number. I don't recall, Mr. Chairman, pardon me for the exact number, but there is an assessment that's charged on every cubic yard of material that comes out, and that goes into the common school fund. Depending upon the volumes and so on, there's at least a cash flow stream that's already coming in for the common school fund. But the depth itself has to be maintained through dredging because of the shoaling effect that you get as a result of material moving. And final point on depth, the river actually only gets down to the 40 feet now, 43 later foot depth, about 2.5-3 months at most out of the year. During the higher flow season, the river has substantially more water in it as you would anticipate. So we're trying to maintain the depth at that critical time. If you don't do that, of course, the whole vessel rotation is disrupted, and if vessels can't come on a regular basis, they aren't going to come at all, is basically the issue we're dealing with. I hope I've responded to your question.
Excellent, sir. Response. And my final question is relative to the income stream and the 43 feet versus 45 feet. Would it be, looking at the graph, if you look at the diminishing returns between 43 and 45, you're still on pretty much the same curve.
That's the cost basis you're looking at.
That isn't relative. That's the operating cost curve for the vehicle.
So really, at that particular point, if you've got vehicles that are capable of operating at 43 and at 45, the relative cost of running those vehicles in, those vessels in, really doesn't increase.
That's correct, and that's in part the response to Representative Beck's question. There is a you gain the greatest marginal value in terms of cost reduction by going from the 40 feet to the 43, as you look on the graph. If you chart out, and the rest of the members, I think Representative Butler has a handout we provided, and we can provide more, but it basically charts what happens to operational costs. Basically, costs become fixed, and so as you get to the bottom end of the chart, as you're showing, there's very little marginal increase for the extra 400 or 500 containers that you might need to put on to make it fully loaded versus coming out at 80% in those extreme cases where you're fully loaded.
And finally, the price that we could obtain dredging the additional 2 feet, in other words, the 3 feet could yield us X number of dollars of return as long as we're digging in that particular spot and it's clean soil. We're digging down to new and into new sandbars that have no prior digging in them. If it's new soil and we can sell it, if it costs us $1.50 per yard to extract it, at that particular point, if we can sell it for free, why wouldn't we be better off to go ahead and try and sell the additional 2 feet and take it at the same time and pick up that additional price?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the value of this product, as I stated earlier, is starting to become realized. As mining sites for aggregate become limited, land use challenges become more a concern. We are finding a tremendous increase. If I can recall, from 92 until 98, the materials marketed out of the Columbia River system has gone from 98 around 1.4 million cubic yards. In 92, if my memory is correct, it was somewhere less than 300,000 or 400,000. Keith, I think I'm roughly correct. I saw those numbers yesterday. But that shows you what has happened as a result of the demand for aggregate. And what I think will happen over time, as it becomes more economical to move aggregate, you're going to see aggregate coming from further down the river moved into wherever the marketplace demand is. I can only predict on how that will play out. But there clearly is going to be an increased demand for the product. And it isn't going to be a question of just putting it someplace, but basically getting where some of it can be used productively in the marketplace.
All right, thank you. Senator Dent.
When do you want to take again?
If we receive approval from the federal funds, as soon as we receive those funds in 2000, we're looking at receiving funds from the Congress in the year 2000, and that will allow us then to start the project at the end of 2000, the beginning of 2001. Basically, it'll be probably in the dredging window of 2001 will be the time that we will start the project. We can dredge during times that have to coincide, Senator Dukes, with the present fish runs and that sort of thing. We have to match up our window with that. And so it would probably be in year 2001 that the project actually will start. We have to show the Congress that we have the commitment available for funds yet this year, and that's why this is so critical. You have to still intend that you can, and then they will complete their process, and then we can start in 2001.
You mentioned the draft EIS, which received a lot of comments. And the feeling I'm getting from the Corps is that they do not intend to redo the draft EIS in its final form, but rather to make a few changes, that they don't want to take the time or spend the money to redo the draft. And my growing concern is that their plan is to respond to some of the louder objectors, either people who have sued them already or who are likely to sue, and not to address some of the other environmental concerns that are, especially by the lower Columbia communities, that are still very real. I haven't heard anything about the use of explosives, for example, the draft is pretty straightforward about the fact that I'm blowing up fish, those kinds of things, but clearly the crab fishermen sued, won their lawsuit, and so they are being dealt with, and I appreciate that, I'm glad that they are, but it was a concern for me. I can understand the practicality of it, but for the Corps of Engineers people to basically tell you off the record, well, no, we're not likely to redo that entire EIS because it would take too long and cost too much money. And I know that you're very, or your staff is very involved in that EIS, and I'd appreciate your comments.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, I think the Corps has made significant changes in the environmental impact draft of overhead. I can tell you also the commitments of the people on the river. Port of Portland has been fairly active. We estimate that before this is done, we will have spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 to $8 million in additional assistance in terms of making sure that the impacts that were identified in the draft statement have been adequately addressed. That's not to say that we're going to be able to satisfy everybody, but I'm confident that we will be able to, with our assistance and with the work the Corps is doing, provide a product that will address the concerns that were raised.
I appreciate that, Mike, but is that because the Corps is not seriously taking on the responsibility of doing it?
I don't want to defend the Corps, and I don't want to be critical of them. I think the Corps is operating within the guidelines that the federal statutes say they have to operate in, and I think they have restrictions and limitations that they have to respond to also. And so, you know, maybe they're best able to respond to that question, but from my perspective, there are certain, just as you have certain restrictions in terms of how agencies function, they basically have the same, and the Corps cannot simply freelance. You recall, the project is basically the function of an agreement between the sponsors, the seven Columbia River ports, and the Corps of Engineers, and we paid essentially half of the cost to do the feasibility study. So by contract, there's a relationship that exists between the sponsoring ports and the Corps of Engineers to scope the project and issue a final report. And so part of the product is basically a function of what's in the contract, and part of it's driven by the statutory requirements that the Corps has to operate on. I don't want to be critical of them. I have been critical. They've done a fairly good job in schedule and moving forward. In fact, this project, since the Congress changed the rules on how projects like this were done, this is one of the first, if not the first, in the United States to go through a sponsor-type relationship. The Coos Bay project that some of you are familiar with was 100% Corps-funded, and that project went on in terms of feasibility for some time. We're on schedule, and part of that's because we're driving the schedule because we have a contract and an understanding, and all the ports were involved in scoping that project. You mentioned explosive. I don't think it's absolutely sure that they're going to need to do any explosive work. That's a question that's yet to be fully resolved. And if it is, it's minor, and it would be in the Longview area, what I understand. Part of the reason for the 3-foot depth, we felt it goes substantially deeper, since we don't think the market really justifies it on the long term, could create a larger set of environmental issues to manage. And we believe that the 43 is an adequate or an appropriate balance here in terms of the regional factors.
And almost, I should also indicate that tomorrow we've invited the Corps to be here. So if members have questions regarding the Corps, we can address some of those things tomorrow. Senator Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, thank you very much for all the explanation. We do appreciate that. But my concern is, right now we are digging 43 feet, obstructing maybe 1% of the bathing distance, but the Coos Bay ships are getting bigger and bigger, the bigger ships, and sometimes that the as the ships getting bigger and bigger, Portland might not be the major player in the future. You stated it might be good on the 2010, 2015. So what happened after that, we might have to visit that for 45, even 50. Are we continue to do that? If not, then do you have any alternative plans that if Astoria or any other port might be available for the leadership? Because I'm talking about the leadership and leadership plans in the future. What, how are we going to accommodate these coming to the potential?
Sir, I'm a very challenging question to respond to, and it requires really putting a crystal ball on the table and trying to predict a lot of things. But I think we can make a prediction based upon what we see today. First of all, one point that I said in my comments, the Columbia River system, including the Snake River feed, is historically has been a grain exporting and a wood products exporting area. Over time, as economies change, it's become also a container port. But if you look at the vessels, this maybe is one way to answer your question. The vessels that actually call the Columbia River system, 33% of them come to Portland. The rest of them go to ports in Washington. Portland is the only container port. Those ports are essentially grain and break bulk and lumber-type ports. So one way of measuring what's going on here is to look at the vessels that are actually in the trade. In terms of tonnage, Portland handles about 45% of the tonnage. This is the last 3 years. We have two classes of vessels, essentially, called the Columbia River. We have the post-Panamax, and those are the ones you talk about, bigger ships, the container ships. They are starting to come into the trade. And they will be vessels in the future that we will need to accommodate, and we think at the depth we're looking at, those can be accommodated within the limitations I described. At some point in the future, I can only guess as to what will happen in the trade, but until the rest of the world, and you know very well, probably better than anyone on the committee, you go to Asia, there are very few ports that can accommodate the big vessels. Hong Kong can accommodate it, Singapore can accommodate it. And there are some ports in Korea, although they're limited in their capability to handle vessels that draft more than 40 feet of water. Much of the mainland China is served by lightering systems. They'll take a big ship, park it, say, in Hong Kong, and put 200-300 containers on a small vessel, and it gets fed off the port. There are billions of dollars of capital required to upgrade the landside ability of the ports in this world in order to accommodate on a mass scale these mega-type ships. And so it's an understanding of that market dynamic that tells me that it will be some time before those vessels are really the common trade in the container vessels, and it will be driven only by those large markets. Los Angeles works because there's 10 million people, and ships come in full, and they unload, and the stuff gets consumed there. Portland is an exporting port. Basically, we're an exporting port. For every cargo that comes in, there's 8, 7, whatever, 6 that go out. And so we basically serve a different marketplace. And that basically is the source of product that comes from not only the local area, but the Inland Empire and that sort of thing. That's the container dynamic. The grain vessels will continue, I think, to be basically Panamax size. Those are the vessels that can come through the Panama Canal. And that's because basically you look around the world and how is grain moved? It's been moved in handy-sized vessels or Panamax-sized vessels. I don't think the economics will drive simply because grain has to be taken to so many different points will drive the need to use these mega ships in grain trade. I haven't seen it yet, and I'm only guessing in the future because of some of the other limitations we described, it won't happen. Again, I'm using a crystal ball. I can't tell you for sure, but I think that the cost, when you come down to the bottom line, look at the U.S. The Congress has backed away from large infrastructure projects. That's why a couple of years ago there was chaos in Los Angeles and products was actually moving to other ports. I just don't think the landside access is there to serve on a mass scale these mega-sized ships. So I think there's the other final point I make is look at the airline industry. You can recall 3 or 4 years ago or maybe before when we were going to have these 800 and 1,000 passenger airplanes. What's the airplane today that's most in demand? It's not the 747. It's basically the 717s and the regional jets. Our traffic has grown 20% year over year on a monthly basis, and it's the regional jets. It's the 80-passenger, 100-passenger type jet that's actually moving people. I think there's a limitation on how big they really can be in terms of effectiveness. Chairman, that's a long answer to a short question.
Yes, and then one concern I have, Congress and I will appropriate 65% at your nation. Are we sure, are they continuing to do that in case we say gone? Then do we have an alternative chance? And following that question, Washington State is a larger economy than ours, almost double traffic. I believe they should have a higher share, even though we've just that we are divided by the Columbia River because they are high, much larger economy. Why couldn't we ask them to pay more than what we can pay, if possible?
Chairman, I'd like to do that too, but unfortunately, we're driven to some extent by federal statute, and the sponsors of this project basically are sponsored based on the two states that have an interest as opposed to some formulas driven by cargo. Even if you would go to cargo, though, as I pointed out, on a tonnage basis, Portland represents about half, 45%. So one would have a hard time, I think, arguing on any other formula that a different distribution was appropriate. I think the quick answer is, as the federal statutes require, I believe we're driven to basically sponsor it on a state-by-state basis, and you split the cost accordingly, and that's the way the original contract was drafted, and so we're probably guided by that as much as anyone.
Thank you. Representative Package.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Storm, I just had a question. I think that we need to deepen the channel and do some things competitively, but what I'm wondering is we're being asked to pay for out of state dollars for the bond, the repayment for the bonding. And I'm wondering what kind of analysis the port has done to look at the fees that are charged for using the ports, any of the rates for the bar pilots, any of those kinds of things on a competitive basis that can help lessen the impact on the state to retire this debt as we move forward. And I'm just wondering what kind of analysis has been done in regards to the competition that's occurred with the other ports, and have we optimized that piece as well? It's easy to come to the state and ask for the bonding authority to do that, but what are we looking at to retire the debt and what's the port doing to maximize those fees so we don't drive business away, but at the same time, we also don't place additional strain?
Sure, that's a good question. First of all, as a general overriding philosophy of how we're trying to run the port, I can only speak to the time that I've been there, and when I went there historically, the port's marine department was operating somewhere between a 4 to 6 million or more loss. And we're projecting break even this year, and that's been a long-term goal. That's in the face of a major five that basically the port was had ready access to 3 or 4 million, 3 million a year. So we are doing everything we can from an operational standpoint to drive our costs down and increase our margins and run it as a profitable business. So we're looking forward to this year of basically achieving that goal for the first time in the history of the port, is basically make it be fully sufficient and take care of depreciation, cost depreciation. To do that, we've had to do much of what you've said, and that's be competitive on rates within the constraints of the marketplace, manage our costs downward. We've reduced our costs in the Marine Department significantly, actual costs. Go back to the beginning and look where we are today. It's costing us less to run the Marine Division than it did several years ago. And I can go on at some length about that, but I understand the thrust of your question, and we're trying to do that. In addition to that, I think the real challenge is what's going on in the marketplace. May of this year, the Congress approved and actually approved the implementation. They approved it prior. The deregulation of the steamshipping industry. So now it's operating as every other mode of transportation is in a deregulated world. The first thing that's happened to show you what's going to happen and it's very distressing to me because I don't believe that this is the right role. Two steamship lines on the East Coast, Maersk and Sealand, got ports in New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, and Halifax into a bidding war over their service. The final decision came down, and the states of New York and New Jersey have committed annually $65 million to subsidize retaining service in their port. That's going to have a tremendous impact on the notion that's going to prevail across the country. So unfortunately, others are doing just the opposite of what you suggested. We're going to continue to be as aggressive as we possibly can in holding rates as fair as we can, and so that we're getting return for the investment we've made. We can't fight the whole world in doing that, but I can assure you that that's our personal commitment, is the commitment of the Commission. And so we try to set rates according to market. We try to set return. There's a question in the money hearing about what happens to docks. We fully amortize the cost of investments that people are making. We make people pay for what they get. You can't be the lone wolf and drive that. You can only go as far as the market lets you go, and I can commit to you that we'll do our best in terms of managing our costs accordingly. The port, finally, I would say, has put, we estimate, as I answered an earlier question, in addition to what's going in, we estimate somewhere between $6 and $8 million of our money is going in to support this project to make sure we address some of the environmental issues. So we're actually pulling quite a bit of costs out. The final answer, I'd say, is that over time, I think the real winner or loser in this project is not the port so much as what happens to the ability of the Oregon economy to continue to function. How can shippers in southern Oregon get product to market, people in eastern Oregon as well as the valley and the metropolitan area? That's the ultimate test of what we're talking about. It's a hard one to fully quantify. But
I guess just as a follow-up, so you're saying you've already looked at all those pieces, you feel that the cost, you've optimized the cost in a competitive nature, not only for your own rates, for the drive rates and everything else, but as well as how much bar pilots are making, all those other
I can't
things.
Control the bar pilots, unfortunately, and they do, they're paid handsomely for what work they do. But I can tell you this, that annually, we review all our costs. We aren't afraid to eliminate costs or eliminate positions if we think it is justified. We've done that. There are fewer people in the Marine Department today than when I went there, and we're generating profits, and that's our goal.
All right. Thank you very much. And again, thank you for coming, Senator Cohen. Mr. Scott, are you willing to come back up and present the next presentation group?
Yes, sir. Now, you asked us to finish our presentation today, and we're in a little bit of a hole here, but we'll do our best to get done.
Okay.
We have, as you know, we originally planned to do a number of community stories that really help you understand, I think, in our new delivery system about how all the different programs work together. We've cut that in half, so we've got three stories to tell here today with the folks from Rainier and Medford and Burns. Then after that, I was just going to briefly cover the line items in our budget for the Progress Board and program services. And then we had hoped to have 30 or 40 minutes to answer questions about our performance measures and so on. I think we'll need to have the community folks, and I think we'll have a little bit of time left over for the rest, and you'll have to guide me about how we manage that time. So maybe we can begin. You also asked, Mr. Chairman, that we have that we include a couple of our regional development officers in our presentation, so that you would see they don't come to Salem any more often than they have to. But we've got a couple of them here this morning, so I'll start out by I think we're going to go with Rainier first, and Bill Campbell, who's our regional development officer for Columbia, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties, and he'll introduce that's telling the Rainier story.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Campbell. I'm the Regional Development Officer for Northwest Oregon, Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties. it's a pleasure to serve that region. And I'm sorry for the faux pas here. I wasn't quite certain how we're going to work this out with two chairs up here and shifting room, so now I know. Anyway, my apologies. With us today is a local team from Columbia County that has been involved in the recruitment of the United States Gypsum Company and in the recovery of the city of Rainier from economic depression and disaster that emanated from the closure of several mills in the area and the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant. Presenting to you today will be Michael Sykes. Mr. Sykes is presently the city manager for the city of Bononia, previously a Columbia County Commissioner and a member of our interim working group. Presenting after Mr. Sykes is Commissioner Tony Hyde, who is presently the chairman of the Columbia County Board of Commissioners and who previously was the mayor of Bononia. Following Mr. Hyde will be Chad Olson, city manager for the city of Rainier, and then in the cleanup spot will be Mr. Peter Williamson, the executive director for the Port of St. Helens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Sykes, and as Bill mentioned, I have served as a county commissioner. Matter of fact, I served as a commissioner when Senator Gooks was a commissioner back in 1985, and also served as president of the Association of Oregon Counties a couple of sessions back, and have worn a lot of different hats in economic development. And like some of the legislators of the past, have been frustrated at times with Oregon economic development, some of its programs. But over the last handful of years, we've seen some dramatic improvement, particularly in our area. I was on the interim work group, and we've been thrilled with the new approach in the sense that rather than worrying about how do we fit into this program, we've seen a whole new direction. Basically, over the last handful of years, we've been able to have a collaboration with our state partners that has allowed us to make some significant impacts. Being on the interim work group, one of the things that I always kept referring back to was the local process that we had. Basically, we had Bill Campbell and the city, the county, the ports, and all the different players working together to try and use resources wisely. And what we've noticed over the last couple of years is that having that hands-on approach from the state has allowed us to take advantage of opportunities as they arrive. Real quickly, just a couple of examples of that. There was an old plywood mill. It was the largest co-op on the West Coast. It closed. We were able to, the port was able to work with our state and federal partners and bring all the different players to the same table and purchase that and 3 years later, there's over 10 companies that operate out of that operation. And so we've been able to put people back to work. Rather than talk a long time about any of the other projects, I would like to mention that we've employed the new directions in Columbia County. And we think a very good example of that is the U.S. Gypsum recruitment, which really would not have happened without the partnership that we had both at the local and state level. And to tell you more about that, I'd like to introduce Chad Olson, city administrator for Rainier. Oh, can you tell me your name?
The committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tony Hyde, Columbia County Commissioner, and current chair of the Board of Commissioners in Columbia County. And I can cite quite a few instances where we have partnered with the Economic Development Department in the state of Oregon in the last few years. But first of all, I want to give you a little bit of an overview of Columbia County and its I don't want to say predicament, but its current situation. We have moved from a predominantly timber county in the last 15 years to a bedroom community or metropolitan area. To strengthen that point, we are by federal numbers at this point at 51% commute outside the county for employment in Columbia County. And as you probably know, if you work out of county, then you shop out of county. And to further strengthen that point, we are now rated the third lowest retail commerce county in the state of Oregon, which to me is a startling number when you consider that we are contiguous to Washington and Multnomah counties. I would, for the purpose of this meeting today, I think that we want to focus more on the city of Rainier in Columbia County. But in 1993, the city of Rainier suffered the loss of Trojan Nuclear Plant as a major employer in that community, and 1,600 jobs went down the road along with that closure, which was 2 years earlier than they had anticipated. Because of that, today the school system, which was the premier school system in Columbia County, and I would say probably one of the premier school systems in the state of Oregon, is now down to a four-day work week or school week and having a very difficult time keeping the superintendent because they simply don't want to make those difficult decisions that are arising because of that. What happened immediately upon this situation in 93 was use of Oregon Economic Development Department and some of the programs that the department has been accused of running came to the city of Rainier by way of RDI, which is Rural Development Initiative, and started a strategic plan to lay the groundwork for some industrial recruitment and some job creation in that community. It also led to some significant leadership training, which built capacity in that community that they had really not developed because they had the luxury of having the jobs available to them. Finally, they ended up with what we call REDCO, which is Rainier Economic Development Corporation, which was an urban renewal district, which led to where we are today with a USG plant. And to further that, I'll turn the mic over to Chad Olson, who's the manager of City of Rainier.
Hey, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it was, as Tony mentioned, in the early 90s when Trojan closed down and the city of Rainier was really kind of looked at that as an opportunity to shape its future and work with partners with the department and RDI. And at the time, they were able to go through the RDI leadership training program and develop the capacity locally to help shape its future. They did the two things that they did coming out of the RDI training was really strategic planning and capacity building. And the capacity building, they were able to do that through creating and developing partnerships with various state, regional, and local entities. And yesterday I was just taking a look at some of those groups, and of course it included OEDD. OEDD basically helped provide guidance and ushered the city into the future, and helped us create the partnerships. So the city went with the Environmental Partnerships Group, DEQ, Northwest Oregon Economic Alliance, the State Marine Board, the county, and the Port of St. Helens. And it was through the partnerships that the city was able to create the groundwork and the base for preparing itself for future development projects. Personally, I believe we would have had a project like USG come in at some point in time, but really what we were able to do is prepare ourselves not to be run over by the project, and we were able to do that through the partnerships that we created. Over the 5 or 6 years after that, the city went through a various period of creating the groundwork, and again, a quick list of what they did. They went through the SWOT, the strength, weakness, opportunity, and threats, developed a strategic plan, updated its comp plan, its zoning ordinance, land division ordinance, waterfront urban renewal plan, transportation system plan, water master plan, wastewater master plan, and created the urban renewal agency that we currently have, the RESCO. And by creating all of the, they went through the planning period and created the base to be prepared for a development project that came in. And when USG announced its decision to locate, we were prepared for the type of information and the background that we needed to pursue that project. So I think it was with the department over the years that helped helped guide us and kind of lead us to the point that we are now, where when a large project like this comes into the community, we're able to respond and see them through the period that they're going through now and getting ready to be up and running. And that's really all the comments that I have. I will turn it over to Peter Williamson, the general manager with Port of St. Helens.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Peter Williamson, the general manager of the Port of St. Helens. I've been with the port for over 16 years now, and so I've seen quite a bit of economic development and programs and other things come and go. And I am here to support the OEDD budget and the components of that budget. I'm going to kind of go through the toolkit that we used. As it's been said, they're here to solve problems, not run programs. My take on that is you solve problems by using the programs wisely. And so I'll go through kind of a quick run through of how this thing was developed. After the closure of Trojan, the city got into gear working with the RESCO group and kind of getting all of their pieces of the project put together in advance. And during that period of time, the port also was getting their pieces of the puzzle together too. Through the port planning and marketing program, we did a market study, which told us that our property in Rainier was a niche property that would be for a proprietary user such as USG. It has a dock permit. And so we had to take a look at where we fit in the world of ports. Do we compete with the Port of Portland and the ports across the Columbia River in Washington, or do we have a different niche? The outcome of that marketing study told us that we had a different niche, and a project such as USG was that niche. And then we ran into our first big prospect that really cemented that market study, and that was Broken Hill Proprietary, BHP, which eventually went across the river into Kalama for entirely different reasons. And during the course of the recruitment of BHP, which we had a significant level of assistance from the department, we used the port planning and marketing program as well as the old growth diversification program to fund geotechnical work, to fund environmental level studies, level 1 and 2, a transportation impact study, and a rail safety study. This allowed us to have the answers to the questions that a project of this magnitude must have before they proceed with the project. They have to have the certainty of those answers in order to make an affirmative answer to the question of whether they locate in the state of Oregon. During that period of time as well, as Chad mentioned, the city was going through the environmental partnership process with the state of Oregon, identifying the issues with their infrastructure and identifying the way to solve those problems. Well, we didn't get BHP. It went across the river to Kalama for reasons that were out of the control of the community as well as the state. And an odd thing happened. When we lost BHP, because of the leadership training, because of the cohesiveness, we increased our resolve. Rather than falling apart as a group, the group chose to raise the level of effort and raise our level of resolve. We then saw another prospect for another steel company. That came and went. They haven't located anywhere. But hot on the heels of that came BHP. And by the time BHP came around, or excuse me, thank you, USG. And by the time USG came around, we were ready. Instead of placing blame or trying to figure out who the fall guy was, through the course of this process and the training that we'd had, we had identified the issues that made us less competitive and had addressed those so that we, during the interim, actually became more competitive than we had been originally. And that was a very important thing for USG because they knew the history of the site and what the community had been through. And part of the reason that they chose Rainier was because of the community resolve and the fact that they would have a local team working with them to resolve issues with a project of this size as it's developed. Then came another part of the toolkit, the resources to close the deal. The port will be involved in a special public works fund for on-site transportation facilities. The city will be involved in the special public works fund for off-site infrastructure capacity to meet the requirements of the project. And the county has applied for immediate opportunity funds through the Department of Transportation, through the coordination of Bill, as well as special public works funds for the off-site roads necessary to connect to Highway 30. All of these pieces had to be in place and had to be coordinated by our RDO. We all have experience in applying for funds and doing individual projects, but the magnitude of this project required that effort to be coordinated. That was the function that that Bill and his predecessor performed for us so that we had the whole package put together for them to say yes. And that package had to be firmed up. We now are into the phase of the project of coordinating the applications for the individual pieces of the project and the delivery of funds, as well as working with the resource agencies to make sure that there aren't any barriers created by any regulatory issues that are associated with the project. Again, I would like to restate that yes, indeed, the department is involved much more than ever in solving problems, but they require a full toolkit to be able to effectively do that. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, Mr. Chair, I would also like to depart just briefly and say that the Port of St. Helens is a channel sponsor, and we very firmly support the channel deepening project and the funding of the channel deepening, and want to restate that that today's business decisions are based on the expectations of the future competitiveness of the river system, and that's very important.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Yee?
Can you tell us what was the reason that you didn't attract HP the first time, and what did you learn so that you can secure the siting of the new plant?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, we were very fortunate with BHP. They gave us a debriefing after they had chosen Washington side. And contrary to some popular opinion, Oregon is a very competitive state. We had a competitive advantage over the Kalama property except for one issue, and that was competitive rail rates. That was the largest issue that drove them over to the Washington side. Access to Interstate 5 was a large issue, and the question of the future of the Lewis and Clark Bridge connecting Rainier with Longview and Interstate 5 was another issue. And a final issue was the readiness of the site, largely a question of appearance, but there were some other issues associated with that. In order, we worked with the State of Oregon Economic Development Department and Department of Transportation to help convert the rail line to Astoria to a short line operation that is now owned by the state. that was the single largest competitive disadvantage that we had. And as I said, it was the deal breaker in our case. So the state and the short line operator now to a large degree have satisfied that that problem. The port in the last session of the legislature got authorization to proceed with the study of replacing the Lewis and Clark Bridge with a toll facility. In fact, as I recall, I was in front of you today during that last session, and you carried the bill to the floor of the Senate, and we appreciate that very much. We're proceeding with that study. It's being funded by the state of Washington, and we, by the end of this year, will have the answers to those questions about the future of the bridge, whether we replace it or whether the existing facility is redone. But we'll have the answer to their access to I-5 question. And then the final one was through the intergovernmental relationship with the Port of Portland. We were able to come in and do some site work that made the site much more competitive than it had been in the past. So there were a variety of things that were necessary that that we successfully have completed.
Thank you. Yes. So the bridge, when the study is completed, will be jointly funded by the two states if it's replaced?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, that's one of the questions that will be addressed. The main question, the primary question, will be whether tolls will support the replacement of that the bridge, and whether the bridge needs to be replaced. And then following the answers to those questions, we are going to look at financing and structure of ownership of the new facility, should that be the way we go. So we hope to get an answer to the question of who will own the bridge and in what fashion as part of this study.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Senator, but I would ask you to keep it brief because the four session is 10 and there's two more presentations to go yet.
It'll be very brief.
Okay.
I see that the plant will employ more than 200 people, and do you make quarterly reports to the department regarding jobs created, cost per job, and return on investment on a quarterly basis?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, we're working out the details on the employment and training package with full description of the jobs that will be created and their approximate salary ranges. And we will be receiving periodic reports. We have not defined the term whether that will be on a quarterly basis or a six-month basis. But we will be measuring on a regular routine basis over the course of the period. The site is within an enterprise zone, and so that would be the normal reporting procedure in order to maintain the qualifications under those provisions.
So you report to both economic department and enterprise zone manager?
That would be correct. The reports would come in for the funding assistance under the Special Public Works Program, and we would consolidate that into a single report to the department, and then reports would also be made on a periodic basis to the enterprise zone manager, who is Jeffrey King with the Columbia Pacific Economic Development District.
And you report to the economic department on a quarterly basis?
That's correct, Senator.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you all. Mr. Scott, the next presenter.
Mr. Chairman, I'll invite Bruce Laird, who's our Regional Development Officer for Jackson and Josephine Counties, to introduce the folks from Medford. Bruce is one of our original Regional Development Officers, so he's been doing this longer than anybody, and I think he kind of wrote the book on how this role is played.
Welcome to the committee.
Thanks very much, Chairman Hanson, member of the committee. It's a great pleasure to be here and see everybody looking so healthy. In the sake of brevity, let me cut right to it. We're here today to talk about our efforts and success to help Oregon businesses expand, to overcome
challenges and to recruit new businesses into the Rogue Valley. The economy in Southern Oregon is going through structural changes. The Jackson County area has experienced an over 8% unemployment rate. Josephine, close to 11%. It's very seasonal. Josephine has one of the lowest average incomes in the state. It's on occasion second lowest. So we have our work cut out for us, but we have a great area and some great partners here today who've taken time out of their busy schedules to come up and talk about their experience working with the department. On my right is Mike Burrell, who was formerly known as Burrell Lumber. He's I think he likes to see himself as a former forest products guy, and now he's a diversified businessman. And on my far, far right is Scott Morris, who is the regional manager of Avista, formerly WP Natural Gas, and very active in the community. Incoming chamber president, I believe. So let's start with Mike, and he'll tell his story and experience working with the department.
Not sure that I really am happy to not be in the timber business. I was in that business for myself about 40 years, my family for 58 years. For the record, my name is Mike Burrell, and I'm president of Burrell Resources now. On the way up last night, I heard a commercial on the radio, and they were talking about the U.S. West bill and trying to provide telecommunications throughout the state and talking about One Oregon. Those of you that were here last session, and we were talking about Senate Bill 710 last session, I remember we discussed a lot about One Oregon and how that when we're doing things that affect the economy in Oregon, we have to look at not just one part, we have to look at the entire state. Mr. Thorne a little bit ago commented about the growth of Oregon in 1997, I believe it was, and we were the fastest growing state in the union. And yet, if you look at that with Oregon as one number, we might do that. You're going to find communities, whether it's Rainier that was here a moment ago, or whether it's Baker City or Bend, or a variety of other places, they may not share that same success. So I think it's important that when we're making decisions that affect the state, that we look beyond just the areas that are growing the fastest and we find areas where we need to provide some extra emphasis. The transition of communities, like we have in Roseburg or like we have in Medford, I think in Rainier, as they were just talking, from a timber economy to something different than that, can be a very painful transition, not only for the community itself, but of course for the people that are affected directly, the employees that have lost their jobs and need to go through retraining or whatever. As my family company was going through those changes, it was quite a rude awakening to us to learn the processes that we had to go through and then to try to not only help our employees to find their new life, but for us as a family to find our new life and to re-identify ourselves as to where we were going in the future. OEDD has been a real partner in that process. We started to convert from a timber company to a real estate development company some years ago, and it's the partnering that we have with OEDD and a variety of others that have brought success to us in that venture. As we have worked with the state and with our local economic development groups, we have been able to attract new industry to Southern Oregon. Some of those are BOC gases that are there now. We brought in Certainty Corporation last year. We located U.S. Cellular, one of their major offices in the area also. But it takes a lot of those in each community in order to make the economy grow. At one time when I was talking to somebody about the need to move some of our economic development efforts outside of the Tri-County area around Portland and try to push into other parts of the state, the argument was used that you can't make a business go where they don't want to go, and I would fully agree with that, and I think everybody would. But often, I think we push them to an area where maybe they don't have to be, when they could just as easily go someplace else. I spend a great deal of time working with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And in doing that and looking at the transportation problems alone, it points out that there are many communities that have an infrastructure in place that can support growth, and we need to work to bring that about. Just kind of wrapping up quickly because I know we're running out of time, Mike Thorne being up here talking before, I want to also go on record of supporting the request for dredging on the Columbia. Again, when we passed Senate Bill 710 last session, and the One Oregon concept and the Ports of Oregon concept, that was part of what was discussed at that time, and we feel very strong that that needs to be done. Just a quick bit of trivia for you. The initial numbers on the drawdown of the Snake and Columbia River system, if the dams were breached, I believe the grain component alone of having to go off barge and to go to trucks would account for 700,000 truck movements per year. That equates to one truck movement each minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the infrastructure that we have and how we work together in Oregon is very, very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to be here. My name is Scott Morris, and again, I'd like to apologize to you, Mr. Chairman, and you, Representative Pastors, for missing you yesterday on the chamber hotline. I was tied up yesterday. What I'd like to briefly speak about is recruiting those businesses that Mike just talked about. Avista Utilities serves not only in Oregon, but we also serve electric and gas customers in Washington and Idaho. And unfortunately for our company, you might say we're not in the main hubs of those states. Our company serves Southern Oregon as well as in the Spokane region and the Coeur d'Alene, Idaho region. As we try to recruit businesses throughout those three states, we've learned a few things. Since we aren't in the Seattle area, the Boise area, or the Willamette Valley, it's very difficult to drive leads to those communities, qualified family wage, family benefit leads into those communities. And here in Southern Oregon, we rely very, very heavily on OEDD to provide us those leads, those qualified leads to get those businesses here. As we've recruited businesses, one of the things that we've realized that OEDD does better than our other partners or other states, if you will, is provide us those leads. Washington and Idaho don't do a very good job of doing that. We're seeing companies in Southern Oregon that they're begging to see in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, and that's a direct contribution to what OEDD is bringing to our community and our region. One of the things as a board member of SoReady that I've been able to serve on for the past 6 years and as their past president, we do a lot of things very well at SoReady, but there's one thing that I think that we can't do very well because it's too expensive, and that is to try to drive those leads into the community. We can't attract certainty. We can't go get U.S. Cellular. We can't talk to DOC gases. We don't have the opportunity or the ability to do that kind of stuff. We need Bruce and his team to bring those people to us so once they're here, we can drive them to the close. And OEDD has done that very, very well. One of the things also that we've realized and utilized with OEDD is their community solutions teams. We've been able to go ahead with certainty, and as we are trying to drive a company called Project Close that we're trying to recruit right now, Bruce, through his efforts and the community solution team, is going through and trying to get through these issues. And with Project Float, it's very interesting to see that we're out in front of some issues that maybe in the past we would have been maybe at the point of the close of the deal, and we would have had about five or six things come up, and we'd have been going, oh, my God, we're scrambling around. We're already trying to address those issues right now. And I think the team that OED has put together is really starting to work for our community. So I know that you're short of time, and I can end it there. The other thing, though, that OED has done for us is also have access to maybe certain federal folks. I know that when we got U.S. Cellular, Bruce was able to get Senator Wyden to come to bat for us, and that was a very key issue. So OEDD really is kind of a full-service organization for us in Southern Oregon, and I'll turn it back to Bruce.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Probably the funnest thing I can say is thank you for your time, and feel free to come back to the building.
Senator Dan, just one last comment before we go, and I forgot to mention this, but the Boise Cascade Fire in Medford, OEDD was a major player in helping to bring about resolution to bring the rebuild of that plant. We want to thank them for that, too.
And we're all glad they stayed in Medford. So, any questions? If not, thank all of you for coming up this morning. Judge White.
Mr. Chairman, just one word on the Boise Cascade Fire. I want to give credit where it's due in the Community Solutions Team. It's really the Department of Environmental Quality that got the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to expedite the answer to the question whether Boise Cascade could use their existing permit to rebuild. That was what made that decision possible on that, and without our other state agency partners through that team process, we couldn't have done it. I'm now going to introduce Judge Dale White. Dale was county judge in Harney County until the end of December for many, many, many years, and is also, it's my pleasure that he serves as a member of our Economic Development Commission, and as such, he sat in with the interim work group and has been through, I think, the whole saga of the transformation in the department. So I think he can tell you a little bit about both how that's affected Harney County, the kind of things they've faced, and also more of a statewide perspective.
Welcome, Judge.
Good morning, Senator Hannon. Pleasure to be here, and a special hello to my colleague from county government, Bid Curran, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Judge.
As Bill said, I just finished up 24 years of county judge in Harney County this January, and have since been retired, and I can tell you it's much more fun to be retired than to be county judge. From the early 1980s to the early 1990s, conditions in the Burns-Hines area were so bad that we took a saying from the old Hee-Haw TV show as our theme song. It was, if it wasn't for bad news, we wouldn't have any news at all. In the early 80s, Edward Hines Lumber Company closed their Hines operations, putting 1,200 employees out of work. We went from a low unemployment rate and the top six counties for average annual wages to an unemployment rate of 30-plus percent and to the bottom of the list for average annual earnings. With the unemployment came mental health, drug and alcohol, and marital problems, increased child and sexual abuse, all of the social problems that comes when your world is turned upside down. And as I'm sure you are aware, the dramatically increased costs for these programs are primarily state-funded. The sawmill operation, with about 125 jobs, is finally purchased by Snow Mountain Pine with the assistance from Economic Development Department. Despite everyone's best efforts, changing conditions, especially the federal timber policy, resulted in the closure and liquidation of the complete sawmill facility in 1993. During the same period of time, Tecton Laminates began to laminate the veneer operation that was plagued with constant operational and financial problems. Once again, the Economic Development Department provided assistance to try and make this a viable operation. From about 1983 to 1989, the community sat around feeling sorry for ourselves, watching business after business close on Main Street, see the value of our homes deteriorating, and for many, losing their homes to foreclosure. And finally, over 15% of our county population was forced to leave to find employment elsewhere. Waiting for somebody or someone to come along to solve our problems for us. Finally, in 1989, we realized that if we were going to be saved, it would have to be done by ourselves. We invited personnel from Lou Tice's Pacific Institute in Seattle to come to Harney County and make a presentation. It was basically a series on self-motivation, on how to set goals and priorities, how to take actions and implementations to accomplish your objectives. We began in earnest with technical assistance from the department and help from RDI, which is a program partially funded by OEDD. For the next 5 years, we did all the right things, followed every lead, other than cleaning and sprucing up our community and developing a positive attitude in our people. Nothing happened. Then in 1994, with the census of OEDD, we were successful in attracting Safari Motor Coaches. Then in rapid succession over the next couple of years, we were successful in being selected for a juvenile correction facility, for the location of the lottery warm site and state computer backup facility, and LP, Louisiana Pacific, purchased Tecton Laminates to begin to operate on a regular and sound basis. The department is presently assisting LP in making some needed changes to make their plant more efficient and profitable. The greatest hope for the future was the location of the lottery warm site. To make this possible, we needed fiber optic communication lines to Burns, and with the help of OEDD, the Department of Administrative Service and the Governor's Office, we were finally able to convince Enron Corporation to lay a fiber optic line to Burns and beyond. The lottery warm site will only provide 4 or 5 jobs, but it does put us on the information highway. We are convinced that the information highway is the vehicle for success in the 21st century. Just as the railroad was its key to success in the 19th century and the interstate highway system was the key in the 20th century. During the past few years, we have been assisted by practically every program that OEDD has to offer. Technical assistance, training, special public works, sewer and water, regional strategies, rural investment, enterprise zones, to name a few. These programs made a difference, in my opinion, in our ability to turn our community from a severely depressed area to one that is again healthy and viable. I'd like to visit with you for a moment about my perspective for economic development policy. I believe that the direction of the Commission on solving problems, not running programs, is the right course of action. That economic development, as any development program, is not just a banking program to be measured by how solid and viable the investment is and what the return on investment is going to be, though these are valid concerns. In our case, the bankers may not have redlined Harney County, but they did refuse to make any loans. And to this climate step, economic development with financial and human resources, not to buy our way out of our situation, but to extend a helping hand and provide hope for a community that was motivated but did not have the needed resources. The first few years saw little or no return on investment. We now have, in my opinion, over 600 primary jobs earning conservatively an average of $20,000 per year, on which they now pay state income taxes, and I estimate that to be at least $500,000 a year. In the last 4 years, the state has recouped its investment and will reap a substantial return on its investment in the future. My point is that the state needs to make these investments in the communities of this state who are not sharing in the present economic prosperity based on their need, not whether there is a guaranteed return on investment. They have a chance to succeed if we provide them with the tools, but are certain to fail if we do not. With assistance, they have the possibility to create jobs that will reimburse the state with income tax payments. If we do not take the chance, do not provide the opportunity, it is for certain that the state will pay far more in unemployment benefits, drug and alcohol treatments, health care and mental health costs, aid to dependent children, and all of the costs associated with unemployment and poverty. The easy battles have already been fought and to a large extent won, and as previously been mentioned in the Oregonian article, June 8, indicated that Oregon had the fastest growing economy in the nation in 1996 and 1997. The communities remaining are faced with extreme problems which will be difficult to solve, but I believe and hope you concur that we should give every community the basic tools that is necessary for success. These communities want to succeed more than we will ever know. There will be failures, but we must continue to give every Oregonian an opportunity to be gainfully employed and become a contributing member of society. Your approval of the OEDD budget will be a good and wise investment in the future of Oregon and its citizens. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Judge. Are there any questions by committee members? Represent that
comment. I've just gone through Burns, and I get through every couple of years, and so the story you tell is the one I find interesting, watching the town change in the last decade. It really was dead. Yeah. In the early 90s, it was sad. And just coming through here a month ago, I was just, you know, amazed at what's going on and the streetscape that's being constructed. My one critique, gets into some of the land use issues that I've raised in this committee before, I think it's great that the town is growing and a casino in nearby, and you've got the lottery and the phone line and the safari plant, but downtown, the old downtown core, is still kind of struggling and dead, and I'm concerned that all the development tends to be new development away from the core of the town and the historic core of the community, and not enough reinvestment. You know, it's all new investment outside, non-pedestrian oriented, huge parking lots, but not a lot of community oriented development. And I don't need to comment on that. It's just an observation that struck me.
Well, that's certainly a valid concern, Representative Beck, and one that we share, you know, through the help of the department and the downtown vitalization. You know, we've had money to loans to redo Main Street through the State Department of Transportation. Main Street was recently paved, new sidewalks have been placed in there. We have an active chamber working on it, but, you know, people have a great fixation of wanting to park right in front of the business that they're going to. You know, in Burns, we only have downtown, our blocks are only 200 feet long, and you know, and I'm as bad as anybody else. If I can't find a parking place right in front of it, I think there's something wrong, you know. But then I'll go to a mall and in the parking lot and walk a mile, it seems like, and think that's all right. I don't know how the human mind works, but Main Street is a major concern.
I'd love to see one of these national hotel chains kind of spruce up one of the buildings downtown, old hotels or something, a movie theater. I just think there's opportunities not occurring. But.
Thank you, Judge. Appreciate it. Mr. Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think the best thing to go next, and we can do it very quickly, is to the Oregon Progress Board budget. That's green tab about halfway through your packet, and I'll introduce Jeff Tryon, the director of the Oregon Progress Board, to just, I think all we need to do is just briefly tell you what's in here and what the program options are.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Cryon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Tryon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Progress Board. I have with me a notebook that has all of the products that the Progress Board has created during this last year and a half, which I will not share with you this morning, but if anyone would like to see it, there is an enormous amount of work that has been created by our staff for state agencies, for others, and I just like to say one thing about our work, which is the Progress Board is recognized globally around the world as a world-class strategic planning operation operated out of the public sector. I'd love to have a chance to talk to you more about that, but I realize that we're very limited in time, so I will skip that this morning. We are a staff of three permitted employees, and we have one. I have one staff slot that I fund out of other resources that I have. The general fund expenditures for this current 1997-1999 biennium are $667,584. We are asking for money to make my fourth staff slot, that is my slot plus three others, a permanent slot. That would be $111,000, which you can see at the bottom of what's called page three with the column that is shaded here. Currently, I have zero money to do a lot of the things that the Progress Board needs to do to keep our planning process current, which is being around the state, involving Oregonians, having focus groups, having meetings in various local communities, and I would strongly urge you to consider funding that expansion because we do have a wonderful operation. My people work as hard as anybody in state government. We create valuable products. We've helped 20 state agencies over the last year and a half improve their performance within state government. Making benchmarks more useful to state government has been my highest priority. And I'll just leave it at that. Mr. Chair had a lot of other information, but I know we're limited with time.
Thank you very much. Question I have is on the Oregon Progress Board. Almost all of your money then is general fund. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Yes. The other large chunk of funds we have is the money that we get from other state agencies to administer our Oregon population survey, which is a 5,000 household survey we do for state government every 2 years.
Where does that show up on the page?
That would show up
Which page are you looking at?
I'm looking at page 3 that you were just working off of. Where does the other fund show up at?
That would actually show up if you look at page number 2, Mr. Chair, with the pie chart.
Okay.
Up in the box in the upper left-hand side. The
sources?
Right, the other sources.
Okay. So actually what we're catching is from 804,000 to, is that the new projected figure?
The amount that was requested within the governor's budget was 804, which included the $111,000 increase to make that fourth staff slot a permanent one, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay. And is there any enabling bill that's going through the system that creates those FTEs, or is this being a budget revelation that has to be decided in this budget?
It needs to be decided in this budget, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Currently, where are those FTEs? Like the progress board positions. Where do they exist now?
They are within the Economic Development Department's.
And you're moving them from Economic Development?
No, we're not moving them at all, Mr. Chair. The request is to take this temporary staff slot that I've had now for the last 6 years and make it a permanent position and then fund that.
Okay. Okay, questions by committee members? Representative Starr.
Thank you. This is pretty bleak. I mean, not a lot of information here. I'd like the other sources that I could break down of where that dollars, where those dollars come from other state agencies.
The other fund sources?
I could break down.
That's not a problem.
I want to provide copies.
My sense is it's all general fund dollars. I mean, really. Some of the other agencies, I mean, those dollars could be spent somewhere in state government.
Chair members of the committee, it would depend on the funding source of the agency from which the dollars were received. So, for example, if they're receiving ODOT. Funding from ODOT, it would not be.
Yeah.
Okay. Further questions? Yes, sir. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to be clear with Mr. Scott, Mr. Chair, that the Oregon Progress Board, which on the original chart shows the Oregon Progress Board on the same level as the Director's Office coming off of the Arts Commission and the Tourism Commission and the Oregon Progress Board. Those are existing boards, but really should be included down with the finance team and program development team and so forth. Is that correct, or?
Mr. Chairman, the reason we display them that way is that the directors of those three organizations actually report to their boards who are appointed by the governor, so they're not within my direct control, although our agency does supply all their administrative services and we do take responsibility for making sure they're spending their money legally. We don't exercise any policy direction over their activity.
Okay. So it's the policy that the OEDD does not exercise any policy authority over the Progress Board. Okay, thank you.
The governor is, in fact, the chair of the Progress Board, and so I report to him.
Representative
Patrick. Can you give me a statute that authorizes the Progress Board, you know, statute anyway?
I don't have it off the top of my head, Mr. Chair, but
1989.
We went to ORF for I'd be happy to get that for you this afternoon. I just don't have it off the top of my head. It was reauthorized in 97.
It was in chapter 285.
Can you just get me the statute number, Connor? Try to push it.
Sure.
257 and 285.
Okay, further questions? No, thank you, Jeff. Mr. Scott.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the last piece of our budget that we haven't covered is a little further back behind the green tab. Next to next to last green tab called Program Services. And you've already this is essentially what the last legislature did was put all of our staff that's not in the three independent agencies into a single line item called program services. You've already reviewed the budget and staff of the international division, and what this does is to summarize the number of staff and page one behind that tab breaks down the funding sources for the staff in the regional service team, which include the regional development officers, our three central teams that mainly work through the regional teams, finance, business and industry, and program development, and then the central services section. The regional teams, just page two just shows you how they're divided up in terms of their region. Some of those people are housed in Salem, as I've said before, and some of them are housed in the field. Page three is the organization chart you were just referring to. That shows you exactly where the FTE are in the department within the overall organization chart. We've already discussed the two FTE program option package for the international team. The one other FTE we're requesting in the program services is tied to the program option package to add $20 million for new infrastructure that we've already discussed in the Community Development Fund. We're not actually certain that we'll put that FTE in the finance team, but we're showing it there for the moment. That may, and we may decide, depending on where we see the workflow developing, that FTE would go to one of the regional teams. We're doing a little shakedown and rethinking of our reorganization right now. That program option package is financed by other funds, and that would be through essentially interest on existing loans in the Special Public Works or Water Wastewater Fund. So that's how that FTE would be financed. Page four just shows you the history of our FTE over the years, and as you can see, we peaked back about eight years ago. Since that time, we've had a number of new programs added, and at the same time, we've had our FTE reduced quite a bit. We're actually down to 135 positions at the moment. We have 139 authorized this biennium. That's because we got cut eight, but four of them, the legislature delayed the cut a year, so it shows you 139 FTE, but our actual position count right now is 135. Currently, if you'll remember, there's one of those new FTE that was requested in the Arts Commission has been dropped as a request, so 140 would be the total request in our budget at this point. Going over to page five, essentially the only expense in program services is personnel and office space and relatively a small amount of services and supplies. You can see what the sources of the funds are: $16 million from a lottery, about 6.7 from essentially from the service by the business finance and community development or infrastructure finance programs, and about $3 million is financed by the community development block grant program. The page five just recaps the shaded column as program services. It shows you the adjustments to current service level to get it to 15.8 million. The only
request for money is within the international division. We already covered that $200,000. There is also a program option package that doesn't involve any new FTE. That's a compensation or a reclassification of half the regional development officer positions, and that's essentially an equity adjustment because we reallocated positions to get there. Those people have been paid out of class now for several years, and we've worked with administrative services to figure out the appropriate solution. We're going to eat the cost of it, but we need those reclassifications. Getting down into the program option packages, the increased infrastructure, $20 million, the third program option package listed there under lottery, is the one that has the other funded FTE associated with it. That doesn't show up on this page because it's not lottery, because it's not lottery funded. And on page 7, there's a recap of those program option packages, so that that's clear, and then they're described on page 8. And then further over behind the international tab on the third page is just we've already looked at it once before, is where the international positions program option package request is. And I'll take questions, I guess, at this point on the program services budget. And then what I wanted to do is just recap the big program option packages just to, because I think there was a little confusion the other day about exactly what do we get for this $55 million.
Okay. Are there any questions? Representative Butler.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, as we reviewed in another budget, we became aware that a portion of one of our offices in a half-time position or a full-time position, I'm not sure just how it was worked out, was funded in Washington, D.C., in sundry activities. We were told that position is presently coming out of OEDD. Where is that presently coming from?
Mr. Chairman, the position and the individual in the position were contributed by economic development when that office was opened 2 or 3 years ago. That position is one of the 8 position cuts that we took in the last biennium, so that's been eliminated in our budget. We are, I think it actually, the position authority is in a limited duration position in our department. Currently, that will expire at the end of the month, and we supply a small amount of the cash to pay the individual along with contributions coming from a number of other departments.
I see. And to follow up again, the continued employment of that individual, are these economic development issues that he's been primarily involved in the past?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I would say the answer is no, not primarily. He spends a portion of his time working on our issues, primarily the continuation of the Northwest Economic Adjustment Initiative, and we've been working for some time to get an Eastern Oregon program comparable to that. But we only pay a minority of his costs, and it's roughly in comparison to how much of his time gets spent on our matters. I think he spends the great majority of his time on natural resource and human services issues, and that's where most of his money is coming from. And there's a position in somebody else's budget, in the recommended budget, and I can't remember right now where.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in the 9901 budget, Kelly Fields with the Department of Administrative Services, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's in the Governor's National Resource Policy Office in the Department of Administrative Services. The package.
That's where the package is.
That is where the package is,
okay.
For continuation of that position.
Continuation in,
right.
In the 9901.
That is correct.
Okay.
can you do a wrap up on Friday morning?
Sure.
All right. If the question is looking, the center is probably going to be under the call shortly. Just got a member check off. Is there any other presentations for today that we need to hear?
The only thing, the other two things I was going to do is I have a recapitulation of the program option package. Where does $55 million go? If you'd like to have that now, we can.
Yes.
I was going to suggest handing it out on Friday.
Okay,
if anybody wants to come see me. And the other thing was we were going to make as brief as you wanted to presentation of kind of the performance measures that we were planning to do at the beginning and answer questions about the document we provided at Senator Yee's request on performance measures.
So and I want to thank you for the answers that you've given the committee here on the questions that were asked and the answers you've provided all the committee members as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Extra copy of her schedule that she provided to you. The schedule of the per job, the dollars per job generated. Somewhere, did we get a copy of that passed down?
Yes, I
distributed it. It's part of the and I went back to look for it and I couldn't find it.
There are three separate letters in this there, Scott. And part of it came yesterday and part of it is
okay.
Yesterday.
Well,
and you might look in the front of your book.
Also, I distributed to everyone's office her request for information, Senator Yee's request for information.
And the response.
Okay. I also just apologize to the committee. The cover letter on this piece was dated June 11th, even though the date that we actually gave it to you was June 4th. So we were a week ahead of ourselves.
Great answer.
That's understandable.
All right. If there's nothing else, we'll pass this whole thing. If there's nothing else, before our committee, we are adjourned until 8 a.m. tomorrow.